Radio Free Alaska. Welcome to Radio Free Alaska, broadcasting the voice of freedom in an unfree world. Today is February 15th, 2023. We're so glad that you are here with us, joining us on this radio broadcast. Today, we're going to be discussing the Great Land, its geography and places, and what it's like being here in such an unusual part of the world. A part of the world that began its life in America as Seward's Folly. And the history of this Seward's Folly is much more interesting than what people know. You know, during the American Civil War, the Civil War was brought on by a number of forces. One of the forces had to do with the slave trading capital in Europe, which was Liverpool, England, which was a place where they bought and sold the souls of many, many slaves. And this slave trading operation was responsible for building up a market in inexpensive cotton. Now, cotton at that time was being produced in really three areas of the world: India, which was controlled by the British East Indies Corporation; Egypt, which was also controlled by the British East Indies Corporation; and the Southern States of America. And to maintain the low price point on this cotton, it was imperative that the cotton be produced by slaves, by slave labor, and not by paid employees. Now, it's very interesting that the cost of a slave is substantially lower than the cost of an employee, although you can't tell that to some of the corporations in America today. But, and you had access to the slave to work six full days a week, or sometimes seven, depending on whether or not the landowner was reverent or not. But this cotton trade was a trade that was being promoted by the British East Indies Company at the expense of the linen trade, which was also developing on the island of Ireland. Now, Ireland was one of the top linen producers in the world, linen coming from flax, which was readily grown in Ireland, and then modified and changed and spun into linen. Today, there is but one linen producer in Ireland, although it is possible to buy actual Irish linen even now. The difference between linen and cotton is quite substantial. Linen is a biblically approved clothing, and which is quite interesting. And there's very little mention of cotton. There's mention of wool, but not of cotton. But cotton became the product of choice because it was being produced very inexpensively in India, Egypt, and in the southern United States. So the motion by the North to terminate slavery represented a direct threat to the cotton industry in the hands of British slave traders, who were prepared to exact penalties on the United States. And part of that was an agitation that ultimately culminated in the Civil War. The irony is that Abraham Lincoln, who was an agent of the Queen at the time, would be elected president, and the South would find his presidency to be illegal. And even though he was an agent of the Queen, he nonetheless was operating outside the scope of the Constitution to secure a federal state at enormous wielding of power over the rest of the country, and they essentially terminate the concepts of federalism expressed in the Constitution up until that point. And so the British had a very strong interest in making sure that the South prevailed in the Civil War. This was noticed by friends of the United States who were very keen to support the Union and to disallow foreign powers, mainly the British, from entering into American naval space during the Civil War. And this country actually put ships off New York Harbor to make sure the British ships would not enter. And they placed ships off the harbor of San Francisco to make sure that British ships would not enter onto the territory of the United States during this civil conflict. It's interesting that the shipping off the coast of California would result in a fort being built. And this fort would be built in a place called Mendocino County today at the Point Arenas, where a small stockade was erected off the coast there, very near the town of Mendocino, California, on the Pacific coast. And this particular fort was declared in possession of this nation, of this sovereign nation that had placed ships within proximity of the United States in order to support the Union. Now, when the Union prevailed, it was William Seward, who was the Secretary of State under Andrew Johnson, the vice president who succeeded to the presidency of Abraham Lincoln following his assassination. William Seward was responsible to more or less pay back the debt to this nation that had ensured our success in the Civil War. And so this payback was to buy the rights that this country happened to hold in Alaska. Now, this country was Russia. And so Seward agreed to purchase this territory that was claimed by Russia in North America for $7.2 million in 1867. A significant sum. Many in America balked at the idea and said, this is ridiculous. Why are you buying this refrigerator for the United States? It's an absurd purchase. They called it Seward's folly. Remember that California had been purchased, Arizona had been purchased. And so this was just another quest to purchase land on behalf of the United States. But in purchasing Alaska, they bought a place that was anomalous to the United States. It was not contiguous to the United States. There was the giant nation of Canada between Alaska and the contiguous United States. And so this appeared to be a bit of a folly. But nonetheless, Seward felt compelled to take money that had been preserved on the blood of Union soldiers and to spend that money on Alaska to repay the Russians who had secured both our western and eastern flanks from British invasion and British participation in the Civil War. We've thanked them all along. Part of our thanks is to put our troops in Ukraine in the Civil War that's going on there and to use our armament to kill as many Russians as we possibly can. But nonetheless, we were able to purchase whatever it was that Russia held in Alaska, we purchased. And so at the time of this purchase, the, you know, Alaska was originally more or less explored by the Russians, primarily the Russian Orthodox. Now, it was a Russian Orthodox priest named Joseph who came to Alaska, and he had established a small parish, and I mean, we're talking very small, you're talking maybe a 12 by 12 building, at a place called Unalaska. Now, this is on an island directly across from the modern harbor that's known as Dutch Harbor, and it's in the Bering Sea, and in Bristol Bay, the Bristol Bay portion of the Bering Sea, out on the Aleutian Chain. And he would row in a rowboat across Bristol Bay to various sites along the Aleutian Chain and up into various villages where the First Nations were situated, such as Naknek, Igigik, and Kangiganek, and visit these people in order to establish the Christian faith, the Orthodox faith, in Alaska. And so he was doing this in the 1600s, Alaska having been initially determined to be a navigable place by another Russian whose name was Vitus Bering. And when Vitus Bering came to Alaska, they named the sea after him, the Bering Sea. Vitus Bering brought a team from Moscow, and this is well before there were any railroads crossing Siberia, and they physically crossed the 7,000-mile trek across Siberia to Vladivostok. And I think actually they ended up near Okhotsk on the sea there. And they can at that point, they cut down timber and proceeded to build their own ship. And so they had nothing but tools when they got to the western coast of Russia. And from there, they built a ship, and they built a ship and got on it and began to sail the Bering Sea and began to determine the coastline of Alaska. Once this happened, they were immediately followed by the Orthodox priesthood, who set out to tame the wilderness by bringing in the Orthodox faith. And this was followed by Alaska's first governor, whose name was Alexander Baranov. Alexander Baranov. Now, Baranov became a very popular name in the Anchorage area and out throughout Alaska as people come to understand the Alaskan history. And so there were hotels named after Baranov. There are streets named after Baranov. There are different services named after Baranov, and so on and so forth. But Baranov initially established his capital on Kodiak Island. And Kodiak Island is, and at that time, was an extremely rugged place. The Orthodox built a church there on Kodiak Island, a fairly significant church, by the way. It wasn't a small one. It was a fairly significant church, the Onion Dome appearing over Kodiak. And the Orthodox began to govern the coastal areas of Alaska. Now, they weren't inland to any great respect at all. I mean, they hadn't gone much farther than up the Cook Inlet. They certainly weren't making land entries into Fairbanks or Nome or any of the central Alaska, which didn't exist at that time. They were mostly inhabiting the coast and working fishing and trapping rights along the coastline. And remember that the Russians are very famous trappers. This is where you get mink and marten and so on and so forth. And they were also trapping in Alaska, including seals and other animals to make parkas and so forth. Well, Baranov eventually decided that Kodiak was not the best climate for a capital. And so he moved the capital from Kodiak across the Gulf of Alaska to Sitka. And in Sitka, he established the Russian capital of Russian America, which we call Alaska, Alexander Baranov. And so the Orthodox Church would begin to expand from Kodiak, and they would come up the Cook Inlet into Kenai. And Kenai, they would establish a church. Kenai is named after the Kenaitse Indian tribe. And then they established their own village at a place called Nanilchik. Now, this is an interesting name because in Russia, there is a city called Nalchik that borders on the Caucasus Mountains in a place called Kabardino-Balkaria, just to the north of the nation of Georgia or Gruzia. But they established this town called Nanilchik and other places like Point Warrensov and Kisilov and other names that would be named after Russians. And many of the Aleuts and Dena'ina people living along Cook Inlet and in Kodiak Island took on not only the Russian Orthodox faith, but also Russian last names. And so many of these tribal members are buried under Russian Orthodox crosses and have Russian last names. one chief of the Dena'ina people up on the in a place called Susitna Station, which was a little tiny village on Susitna River, just south of the Yentna River, place called Susitna Station, one of the chiefs of the tribe there took on the Russian name Vasily. Vasily is Russian for king. In Greek, it's Basil or Basilius, Basil. But in Russian, Vasil, you know, the difference between the V and the B, very slight. Vasil. Vasily, who came to be known as Vasila, in which the town Wasila was named after. Vasily, the king. So unbeknownst to the people living in Wasila, who think the name is Wasily, it's actually named after the Russian for king. And so now you see, for instance, at the Aklutna tribe, there is a Russian burial ground. And most of the Orthodox churches, including the large Orthodox cathedral in Anchorage, is populated by First Nations, namely the Dena'ina, the Aleuts. So this was the history, and Seward came back to the Russians and to say thank you, because the Russians essentially wanted to unload the burden of governing this place. And to say thank you to the Russians for the help in the Civil War, Seward purchased the state of Alaska for $7.2 million. Now, this is in 1867. And so largest metroplex, if you will, living environment, village-type area in the northern Cook Inlet was not Wasila, was not Anchorage, but rather it was Susitna Station on the Susitna River just south of the confluence of the Susitna and the Yentna rivers. Right. Now, with this being the case, we see the Kenai'tse tribe were also gathered on the what we now call Kenai Peninsula. And so things are going to change now as Alaska becomes part of the United States, and the United States begins to attempt to populate and to govern this area, which had so few Alaskans that even when Judge Wickersham held the first trial in Alaska, I believe it was in the teens, he could only find 12 qualified American jurors in the entire state. So there were very, very few people in Alaska, and Fairbanks was nothing to speak of, a mining town, a little tiny mining town, and Anchorage wasn't formed until 1913. Now, in 1913, the United States government had decided we're going to build a railroad, and we're going to build a railroad from a southern port that we're going to name after William Seward. We're going to call it Seward. We're going to put it in Resurrection Bay, along a pretty good-sized port, great place to put up shipping, and then we're going to build a railroad that's going to go up to this mining community in central Alaska that sits on the Chena River. The Chena River, pretty good sized river, drops into the Tanana, which is a very large river, which drops into the Yukon, which is a huge river. In fact, the Yukon is the single largest river in North America. And there are places where the Yukon is more than a mile wide. But the Tanana is a very substantial river, very deep, very large, very fast moving. And so here is Fairbanks, a little gold mining place situated on the Chena. And the determination was we're going to build a railroad, and it's going to go from Seward, and it's going to go to Fairbanks. So as they built this railroad, they came upon a place that looked kind of like a plateau. Okay, this is kind of flat land here, broad enough where we could build. And so they began to start a community along Ship Creek. Now, Ship Creek, you know, I grew up on Ship Creek. I love that little creek. Of course, it's not that little, but we used to play in it all day long. But Ship Creek is a pretty good-sized creek. It runs out into Cook Inlet. And along this creek, they decided we're going to put a railroad depot here, a little railroad building, and let's let a community build it, and let's call it Ship Creek Landing. So in 1913, a tent city popped up along Ship Creek called Ship Creek Landing. And these were canvas tents. Actually, I think they were made of hemp at the time. They were hemp tents, and they would put floor panels on the ground, and they would put about 3 feet to 4 feet of floor panels around the wall, And then you would have the hemp tent above it, and you would have a wood stove in there. And this was how the whole city of Anchorage was birthed. It was birthed in tents. And so in 1913, it was all tents. In 1914, all tents. And in 1914, the election was made. Well, here's what we're going to do. The hill that is to the north of Ship Creek, we're going to give that hill to the government. So let's call that hill Government Hill. And the hill that's to the south of Ship Creek, we're going to build the town up there. And let's call that Anchorage. And so it was in 1915 that the city of Anchorage began to form. And it began to form with First Avenue running right in front of the railroad depot at Ship Creek, then Second Avenue about halfway up the hill, and Third Avenue about three quarters of the way up the hill until you get to Fourth Avenue at the top of the hill. And so Anchorage began to be constructed in 1915. And while this town was building, it was in a competition, if you will, with Juneau, which had become named the capital of Alaska, and Fairbanks. So Juneau had been formed before Anchorage was formed. Fairbanks had been formed before Anchorage was formed. And when Anchorage was initially starting out, they were bigger communities than Anchorage. Even Nome was a bigger community than Anchorage at that time. And most of these places were inaccessible to one another. In fact, Fairbanks didn't become accessible until the Alaskan Railroad reached Fairbanks. Then it was possible to take the train. And when you took the train, they had a whistle stop protocol so that if you were living anywhere along the tracks, you could simply pull the cord, the train would stop and let you off. And if you needed to get picked up, you knew the train was coming, you'd stand by the tracks and wave, and the train would stop and pick you up and take you into either Anchorage or Fairbanks. Now, civilization began to change a little bit because another community that was blooming at this time, if you can call it blooming, would be Valdez. Now, Valdez took on the name Valdez, you know, El Dorado. There's gold in Thumbnail Hills. So there was a belief that Valdez was a passageway to gold mining. And many gold miners came up in the gold rush that took place in the late 1890s and thereafter. And they would tramp into Valdez, a port city, and they would tramp over the Valdez Glacier. Now, what the people in Valdez did not recognize was that they were building literally on the mouth of the glacier. And so everything where they had built the city was just nothing more than a gravel deposit off the face of the glacier. And they built the whole city right there. And so people would come to Valdez and they would hike over the Valdez Glacier and up over the Columbia Ice Field to get points unknown where they would attempt to do gold mining. Unbeknownst to them was that Valdez was really a dry hole. And so nothing came of the gold through Valdez, and Valdez kind of suffered. It kind of grew and then didn't, and kind of then didn't, and kind of then didn't. But nonetheless, it was determined that a highway should be built from this port city, Valdez, to Fairbanks. And so a highway was built called the Richardson Highway that was built between Valdez and Fairbanks. And this was the only connect by road from the southern part of Alaska to the northern part of Alaska. This was the case until World War II. Now, most people think about World War II and they say to themselves, well, the United States was never invaded in World War II. Well, this is not true because Alaska was invaded in World War II by the Japanese. And the Japanese were doing what they had done in the rest of the Pacific, which was to make a move on islands and to acquire islands. And so they had come after the island of Attu, way out in the eastern part of the Aleutian chain. They began to move towards Alaska with an attempt to conquer Alaskan territory. And so real battles were fought with American troops withstanding Japanese troops on the islands of the Aleutian chain. This was occurring in the late war, 43-44. So it was determined that we need to have a roadway that would allow the United States to ship necessary military supplies into Alaska by means of a highway. And so the highway was determined to be built that would go from deep in Canada, the northern part of British Columbia, across the wilderness of the Yukon Territory in northern British Columbia, which at that time was total and complete wilderness. It's not much different today, but it's very much a wilderness. And so the Corps of Engineers launched this campaign. Now, they put almost an entirely all-Black American crew to work this road. And this crew was determined to demonstrate, we know what we're doing. And so they started into this construction of what was 1,200 miles of dirt from Dawson Creek, British Columbia, to the Alaskan border. And it would continue on as a dirt road another 400 miles to the city of Fairbanks. And so because this was a highway that was both in Alaska and in Canada, it was called the Alcan Highway, Alaska-Canadian Highway, Alcan Highway, and it's always been known as the Alcan. And the Alcan was this long strip of very dangerous and treacherous dirt that went through pure wilderness. When they first finished it, there were many, many creeks that had no bridge. They just brought the roadway down to the bridge, and you were required to ford the bridge in your vehicle. And it was designed primarily for military trucks to be able to haul military supplies into Alaska. Now, in addition, they also built major airports to handle air supply drops into the state. So by the time we get to the end of World War II, we have the Alcan Highway going to Fairbanks, and we have the Richardson Highway that runs from Valdez to Delta Junction and connects to the Alcan Highway into Fairbanks. This was the status of the highways. Now, between then and 1960, Anchorage continued to grow and continued to be the choice of people moving into Alaska, still a territory of the United States. And so another highway was built connecting Tok Junction to Anchorage, crossing over the Richardson Highway at a place called Gulkana and Glen Allen. And so at Glen Allen, the Glen Highway proceeds from Glen Allen into Anchorage. And this was the condition of the highway when my parents drove our family to Alaska in 1963. So we drove the 1,200 miles of dirt. It took us 10 days to drive the 1,200 miles of dirt over the Alcan Highway in February of 63. It was the first time I'd ever seen snow. My mother managed to put the car into the ditch at one point. We had snow up to the hood. It was a very interesting trip, very interesting time. And we arrived in Anchorage. But to get to Fairbanks required you to drive back out to Glen Allen and take the Richardson Highway up through Paxson, up through Big Delta, and back into Fairbanks. This status didn't change until 1965. And in 1965, the state began constructing a road that would go from Anchorage to Fairbanks called the Parks Highway. And this highway, where it left the Glen Highway, people were already beginning to settle in homesteads, and they were settling in the place being named after Vasily. And it was a town called Wasilla. And so in 1968, Wasilla was essentially a train station where the train ran to Fairbanks. And you had Thielen's Grocery at the intersection of Goose Bay Road, which was a gravel road, and the Parks Highway. There was Thielen's Grocery. Then there was the Dew Drop Inn across the street, and then up the hill, Wasilla High School. This was the village of Wasilla in 1968, a very tiny, small community. And ultimately, Cars elected to open up a grocery store there, and when that happened, the town began to expand. Now there are over 100,000 people living in the valley in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. And the Matanuska-Susitna Borough is huge, by the way. It's about the size of New Jersey. And when we talk about Alaska, and let's just wrap this up here when we go through this, you have to remember that Alaska is one-fifth the size of the contiguous United States, the entirety of the lower 48, we call it. Coastline in Alaska is almost twice as long as the coastline of the contiguous United States. In addition to Alaska being the far most eastern part of the United States, it's also the far most western part, as a portion of the Aleutian Chain crosses the international dateline. So you have the farthest end of Western civilization is expressed on the Aleutian Chain, and the beginning of Western civilization, where East meets West, is also expressed in Alaska, where the Aleutian Chain crosses the international dateline. The international dateline is an arbitrary and capricious line which divides Little Diomede Island in Alaska from its neighbor Big Diomede Island, a mile and a half away. Big Diomede Island being a day ahead of Little Diomede Island. And Alaska, back in the day, used to have two time zones. It's now been reduced to one, but it used to have two time zones. To give you an idea how big this is. Now, to give you an idea how big it is, to drive from Fairbanks to the North Slope is about the same distance as Seattle to San Francisco. And to drive from Fairbanks to Anchorage is about the same distance as driving from San Francisco to Los Angeles. To go from Prudhoe Bay all the way to Homer is a greater distance than driving from the Canadian border to the Mexican border through California. That's just the center of the state. We haven't talked about what it is to go to Tok or what it is to go to Nome or what it is to go to the fourth world in Bethel, Dillingham, and Nalchik and Naknek and so on and so forth. So these are the places of Alaska. And I wanted to just let you know, to give you a little bit of background of what it's like and why this is called the last frontier. Thank you for being with us. Tomorrow, by the way, we're going to take up on popular demand. We're going to take up the reading of Tusk for 2 days in a row. We'll be doing Tusk on both Thursday and Friday. So stay with us. Radio Free Alaska, the voice of freedom in an unfree world.